America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A recent decision, this is from Fox News just now, a recent decision by German officials to withhold support for any new sanctions against Iran has pushed a broad spectrum of officials in Washington to develop potential scenarios for a military attack on the Islamic regime, Fox News confirmed. Political and military officers as well as weapons of mass destruction specialists at the State Department are now advising Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice that the diplomatic approach favored by Burns has failed and the administration must actively prepare for a military intervention of some kind in Iran. We have with us Norman Podhoretz. He is the author of a new book, World War IV, The Long Struggle Against Islamofascism, also sometimes referred to as the godfather of the neoconservative movement, editor-at-large of Commentary Magazine, been the editor-in-chief for 35 years, adjunct fellow at the Hudson Institute. You were affiliated, I believe, Norman, with the Project for New American Century.
Yeah, yes, I was. Mm-hmm.
What were you guys thinking back in 98 when you recommended to Bill Clinton that he should attack, that he should be taking out Saddam Hussein and attack Iraq?
Well, we were thinking exactly what the Clinton administration itself professed to think, that Saddam Hussein was trying to develop weapons of mass destruction and that he posed a great and serious danger to the United States. Madeleine Albright, Clinton's Secretary of State, was saying this. Clinton himself, Sandy Berger, his National Security Advisor. In my book, I list all the quotes that seem quite incredible today in light of the fact that all these people claim that they were lied to by George Bush about Saddam Hussein. So when we wrote that letter, I think it was addressed to the president, we were simply encouraging him to do what he himself said he wanted to do, and that would be, and that was necessary to do.
But he didn't. I mean,
no.
He didn't attack Iraq.
Well, as a wag said, you know, when someone pointed out that the Clinton administration had said all of these things about Iraq long before Bush came into office, the answer was, but at least he didn't do anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have to salute him for that. You recently said that, and by the way, you've also, Rudy Giuliani has announced that you're part of his foreign policy team. Congratulations
right.
on that. You have said that your plan to bomb Iran would, quote, unleash a wave of anti-Americanism all over the world that will make the anti-Americanism we've experienced so far look like a love fest. Was that a quote out of context, or did you mean it the way it sounds?
Well, it's only out of context in the sense that in making the case for bombing Iran, which I did in the article from which you just quoted, and I also do in my book, I was trying to be give an honest account of the worst case scenario that might follow from bombing Iran, but I took the position, I take the position that, as Senator McCain once said, the only thing worse than bombing Iran is allowing Iran to get the bomb. And oddly enough, the President of France, Sarkozy, recently said something similar. I believe that President Bush is going to do this, but in making the case, one of the things I said was that nothing else would work to head an Iranian bomb off, not negotiations, not sanctions, and not encouraging an internal...
Well, according to the IAEA, there's no evidence that there's an Iranian bomb in the offing. They say, the International Atomic Energy Commission, or agency, rather, of the United Nations, they're in there. They have inspectors in there. It's wide open.
Yeah.
And they say that they're enriching uranium up to the 3% more or less level that's necessary to fuel a nuclear reactor, not the 90-plus percent level necessary for a bomb.
Right. But I don't think even the
IAEA... You don't
IAEA,
believe them.
No, of course not. And neither
and you didn't believe them before we attacked Iraq either, when they said that there was no nuclear weapons in Iraq.
Yeah. Well,
back in the 70s, back in 72, Nixon came back from negotiations, maybe it was 73, came back from negotiations with the Soviet Union, and with I think it was Khrushchev at the time, and came back and declared that the end of the era of terror was over. and that Americans no longer needed to fear the Soviet Union. He announced détente within a year. Yeah. An organization was put together by you, I believe, Don Rumsfeld and others, called the Committee for Present Danger.
Yeah.
And do I have that history correct?
Yeah, roughly. I mean, actually, the Committee on the Present Danger was formed a little later to lobby against the SALT II Treaty.
Right.
But it expanded into a general, bipartisan effort to persuade the country that the Soviet Union remained a threat, and that they were in fact forging ahead of us in the arms race, and that SALT II would be another incentive for them to further arm, while it would lead us to disarm even more than we were already doing.
Right. Now, back in the 70s, your Committee for the Present Danger ran ads and did, you know, held discussions and think tank sort
right.
of things about how the Soviet Union had secret submarines that were able to evade our sonar technology. The CIA came out and testified in open testimony before Congress that there was no such technology, this super weapon of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Don Rumsfeld, on the record, said, see, that's proof that it actually exists. After the Soviet Union fell, we found that the Committee for Present Danger's hyping of the danger didn't exist, that there was no such submarine, never had been. We found after Iraq that there was no nuclear weapons that you suggest. I mean, you were wrong in the 70s. You were wrong about Iraq. Why should we think that you're right about Iran, and we should take the world to the brink of World War IV, the title of your book? We're talking with Norman Podhoretz. When you've been wrong so many times in the past.
Well, I don't think I was wrong in the 70s. I don't remember anything about that submarine. I certainly had nothing to do with with talking about that. I certainly was not wrong about the Soviet threat and about the degree of Soviet armaments at that period. I was not wrong about Saddam Hussein. In fact, if I was wrong, I actually think that he did have chemical and biological weapons that were probably shipped to Syria. But the fact of the matter is that every single intelligence agency in the world, including the French, and every single American intelligence agency, all 15 of them, believed without any question that Saddam Hussein was in possession of chemical and biological weapons and was trying to reconstitute his nuclear program.
I don't believe that's true.
You read the
Downing Street memos, you see that the British Intelligence Service had some substantial doubts about that. The United Nations, you had Hans Blix coming out saying there's nothing here.
Look, you're interviewing me, let me talk. The fact of the matter is that the only doubts that were expressed by any American intelligence agency had to do with nuclear weapons. It had nothing to do with chemical and biological. Everyone signed on to that. And even Hans Blix, who was skeptical, actually said that there was no way of proving that they did not have nuclear weapons. So I was not wrong, we were not wrong, and I don't think there's hardly anybody, but evidently you, who doubts that the Iranians are on the way to developing a nuclear capability. And I think it would be criminally irresponsible to allow them to succeed, just as I think it would have been irresponsible not to topple Saddam Hussein.
Okay, we find now that, according to a new poll of Pakistanis, that Osama bin Laden is now more popular in Pakistan than Pervez Musharraf. 46% of Pakistanis think that bin Laden is the greatest guy in the world. 38% support Musharraf. George Bush, 9%. Our invasion of Iraq has led to our being reviled and hated and turned Osama bin Laden around the world into some sort of a bizarre hero.
Yeah,
meanwhile, we discover that Saudi Arabia continues to send millions of dollars to al-Qaeda, and we're doing absolutely nothing about it. They weren't even identified in Petraeus's charts yesterday. What's going on?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the hatred of America and the popularity of Osama bin Laden goes back to long before we had anything to do with Iraq. Goes back before 9/11. I cite in my book a poll that said that something like 90% of people polled by Al Jazeera television said that Osama bin Laden was a hero and sympathized with Al Qaeda's objectives. So it had nothing. It had nothing to do with our invasion of Iraq. As for Pakistan, Pakistan was a useful ally in providing intelligence in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, and making an alliance with Pakistan which was certainly not a friendly country and harbors enemies, no different from having made an alliance with Stalin against Hitler in World War II. You have to go after the immediate danger, and sometimes it's necessary to strike alliances, as Winston Churchill said, with the devil in order to defeat the worst devil.
Norman Podhoretz's book, World War IV, The Long Struggle Against Islamofascism. Thank you, sir, for coming on the program today.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, you heard it from the horse's mouth, from Rudy Giuliani's foreign policy advisor. Bomberan now. Bomb, 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 bomberan. Remember the days when our presidential candidates did not speak of war, but instead spoke of peace? It typically was those who had actually served in the military. John Glenn, for example, running for president in 1984. This is one of his TV campaign commercials.
My real question is, as a military person, are you likely to get us into more combat, into more wars? Tell me what we can expect from your background and how you will handle those kinds of things.
Now, I'll tell you this. I think as a military person, I am less likely. And let me tell you why. I have a military background, as I said, 23 years in the Marine Corps. I've been there. I've been shot at myself. My plane was hit on 12 different occasions. I know the terrors of war firsthand. I know what it's like to come back from a mission and sit down and have to write a next of kin letter to people I knew in the States. Friends, your husband isn't coming home. Your father is not coming home. I know what that's like. And that sears your soul. I can tell you that. I don't want to see combat ever visited again on anybody if we can possibly prevent it. And nobody is going to negotiate any harder for peace than I will.
John Glenn for president. Leadership for the future.
Yeah, back in the day, 1984. Or for that matter, Jack Kennedy, just addressing the issue.
I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth too rarely perceived. And that is the most important topic on earth, peace.
This is the 10th of June, 1963.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
Where are the statesmen who will speak out like this?
I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task.
No more urgent task than peace?
No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue.
And yet, here we have people saying, well, let's just go in and bomb Iran. Let's just start right now. Let's just bomb Iran. And at the same time, ABC News reporting Brian Ross reports, ABC News, despite 6 years of promises, U.S. officials say Saudi Arabia continues to look the other way at wealthy individuals identified as sending millions of dollars to Al-Qaeda. Stuart Levy, the undersecretary of the Treasury in charge of tracking terror financing, this is a guy working for the Bush administration, says, quote, if I could snap my fingers and cut off the funding for one country, it would be Saudi Arabia. Talking about Iran. Not one person identified by the United States and the United Nations as a terror financier has been prosecuted by the Saudis, says Levy. Meanwhile, our policies are making us hated all over the world. This is really, really good news for the military-industrial complex. They're doing very well, thank you very much. But for human life, why is it that it's the guys who've served in combat, like John Kennedy had his boat blown out of the water, who are the ones who speak of peace? And the ones who have never served in combat are the ones who are all gung-ho to fire off the bombers.
Meanwhile, we seek to strengthen the United Nations to help solve its financial problems, to make it a more effective instrument for peace, to develop it into a genuine world security system, a system capable of resolving disputes on the basis of law, of ensuring the security of the large and the small, and of creating conditions under which arms can finally be abolished.
Just one last final thought here from John Kennedy.
The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just.
27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Fox News reporting that the Bush administration now internally seriously discussing how to go about a military strike in Iran. Tom Hartman with you.
The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here back with you. TomHartman.com if you want to check out our message board, if you'd like to hang out in our live chat room. No charge. Drop in. I'm there during the breaks, typically. Say hi to folks. And David is there. Louise is there. We're all. And there's a whole bunch of folks literally from all over the planet listening to the program and hanging out in real time over in our live chat room. You can get there at TomHartman.com or go to AirAmerica.com, and there's a link to the Tom Hartman page, which links back to that. So it's all there. Plus, we have the message board over at TomHartman.com and, of course, the blog at AirAmerica.com. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States. Jeff in Detroit. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Tom, how are you?
I'm fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, the interview was pretty telling. I just wanted to mention, you know, I'm one that comes from the right, you know, traditionally. A born-again Christian, which I know probably a lot of your listeners think bigoted and everything like that. However, I'm waking up. I'm waking up to what's going on, all this warmongering. And
It is not what Jesus would do.
Well, that's what I'm trying to convince all my Christian friends who support this war. I mean, Jesus talked about loving your enemy and doing good to those who hate you. And there's none of that in this war. And he wasn't talking about being good to your neighbor next door. He was talking about people, being good.
And not only that, Jeff, it's good policy. The reason that arguably terrorist groups that we don't like, you know, Hamas, Hezbollah, the way that they have been able to gain such a strong foothold and such popular support in places like Gaza and Lebanon is because they're running hospitals, they're running schools, they're feeding the hungry, they're caring for the poor, they're running orphanages, and when you do those things, people go, hey, these guys must be good guys. I think I'll support them. And tragically, in this case, these are people who say that, you know, that Israel doesn't have a right to exist, blah, 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 and they're the bad guys, right?
Right.
But they're doing the right things. Why don't we do the right things instead of doing the wrong things? Because we're the good guys.
I know. Can I just tell you something real quick? I want to share this with you. I was listening to one of our, in Detroit here, one of our right-wing Christian radio stations, and the host was, just salivating over this Petraeus report. And, you know, of course, to him, he was making it sound like it was just a wonderful thing. And I started challenging him on this war, and he actually admitted that this war is about oil and that our economy is important and that, disregard all that, God is still in this war, is what he said. And I thought, if anybody buys this, I mean, give me a break. We're going to trade blood for oil, and that's the Christian thing to do.
Not only that, it's $1 trillion we're spending on this.
How much is our oil costing? For our kids. Thank you.
Yeah, it really is. Thank you, Jeff. Thanks very much for the call. I appreciate it. Michelle in Fullerton, California. Hey, Michelle, welcome to the program.
Hey, welcome. Thanks. And tell that guy, Jeff, he absolutely rules. When I do protests on the corner, it's usually the ones with the crosses on the back that flip me off the most. But I wanted to talk to you about...
Yeah, this is where I think Christianity needs to... Just like I say, Republicans need to take back the Republican Party. Christians need to take back the name Christianity.
I proudly identify
myself as a Christian because I believe that for a whole variety of reasons, but one of them is that I believe that Jesus' values are solidly historically American values, and they're what Jeff and I were just talking about. And it's not about declaring, you know, unilateral preemptive war on people. That is anti-Christian.
I know, but what I was calling about is the gentleman that you just spoke to in regards to World War IV.
Yes, Mr.
Potterhurst. I wish I would have been able to speak to him. A, is his kids going to go to Iran and make sure that this is taken over and that they're going to do their job in the military? Or is it just us, part of military families, speak out and our military that will take care of this? I mean, he doesn't have any of his family in the military, correct?
Well, I really don't know, and we have a policy generally in this program of not picking on people when they're not here to defend themselves.
I have no idea.
But your larger point, Michelle, and I think it's a well-made point, is that right across the board in the Bush administration, when you go back and you look at it, and there's no shortage of documentation, the best of it is this movie that's out right now called No End in Sight, is that those
great
people
movie.
Who had military experience, who had seen combat and had seen people die in battle, were opposed to attacking Iraq by and large, and those people who had no idea what the hell that war really is were the ones who were all gung-ho to go after him.
And what's interesting is I talk to a lot of, being part of MFSO, I talk to a lot of military families, and one of the questions that comes up, which is really amusing, is they're saying, look, we're going to attack Iran because of the nuclear proliferation. Israel's never signed nuclear proliferation things, but yet we still support them.
Nor has India, and we just sold them a whole bunch of nuclear technology. Michelle, excellent points. Thank you very much for the call. Chris in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, listening on KEUN. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom. Great show. I'm always impressed that you always seem to take on the most confrontational interviewers right off the bat.
Well, I think it's really important that we listen to these voices. I mean, here's the guy who's the godfather of the entire neoconservative movement going back to the 1970s on the one hand. On the other hand, he's the top foreign policy advisor to Rudy Giuliani, who may well be the Republican nominee and conceivably could even become president of the United States. I think it's really important that we be listening to their voices and that we take them on, you know, and that we challenge them, but that we also listen to them.
Definitely. I wanted to make a comment about the neoconservative ideology. It seems like they have a propensity to consistently overestimate the threats that are against us. And I was thinking, as you were interviewing him, I was thinking of Donald Rumsfeld's presentation on Meet the Press, where he had that big graphic of the supposed underground mountain bunkers that Al-Qaeda had in the mountains of Afghanistan. And it looked
Tora Bora.
Out of a, yeah,
And none of it existed. None of it existed. I don't think most Americans even know that none of that stuff existed, that it was just a bunch of rocks.
And I feel like they must get their own sense of importance from the whatever the threat is of the enemy. They derive their importance from how big the threat is. And if there is no threat, they have no clout. And that's why I feel like we're constantly told to fear, told to be on alert, told that they're the only ones that can protect us. And you know, I was disgusted yesterday with 9/11, watching all of them come out and whip out the psychology of fear on this country again.
And what was even more outrageous, good point, Chris, and well made, and what was even more outrageous, as Barack Obama correctly pointed out before the Senate, although none of our media pointed it out, is that Saddam Hussein and Iraq had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11. Why are we hearing from Petraeus about Iraq on 9/11? The symbolism of that was not lost, I think, on most of us, and the unconscious symbolism was very powerful. And you know, the latest study, a third of Americans think that Saddam Hussein was directly involved with 9/11. And he not only was not directly involved with it, he hated Al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden, the reason that Osama bin Laden got thrown out of his own country of Saudi Arabia was because he organized a little ad hoc army to attack Saddam Hussein on the Iraqi border. And this so infuriated the Saudi royal family that they exiled, they stripped him of his citizenship and sent him back to what was it, Somalia, as I recall, where his mother was from. And they said, no, that's it, you're out of here. Because he hated Saddam Hussein. I mean, these guys were mortal enemies. But the fear card, fear, fear, fear.
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Yeah. Jim in St. Joe, Michigan. Hey, Jim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Hey,
sure.
Tom, I got a question about why did terrorism bring this preemptive war in your estimation? And I still remember when Clinton bombed Iraq in 98 and why he bombed Iraq. I mean, he sounded like President Bush.
Dealing with violations of the no-fly zone?
No.
In the north and the south?
No, exactly not.
What did I miss?
Clinton, he said that I am bombing Iraq with unanimous decision of my Security Council because of his weapons of mass destruction, biological, chemical, and nuclear capability.
Oh, yeah, that was at the suggestion of Scott Ritter. Exactly. Scott Ritter went in there with the UN weapons inspection team. And in fact, we have, you know, Scott Ritter told this story on this program. They spent, a couple of years searching all around the country. They got it down to that over 98%, they could verify that over 98% of all the weapons of mass destruction had been destroyed. And there was this remaining 1 or 2%, and there was a half a dozen buildings that Saddam was playing all these games with them about. And so finally Ritter said, that's it, pull the plug, and Clinton pulled them out, and he blew up those 8 buildings. And at that point, Ritter, the UN weapons inspector, and most U.S. intelligence was of the opinion that 100% of the weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein had left over from 91 were gone. And in fact, now evidence demonstrates that exactly is what happened. Ken in New York City. Hey, Ken.
Hello?
Just about a half a minute here before we got to take a break. Quick one.
Hello?
You're on the air, Ken.
Yes. Progressives, we're not taking over the media. We don't own a TV channel. We don't own a TV network. Hello? Are you here?
Yeah, I am.
Why
to your point.
Why aren't we getting our money together? We can let a guy like Rupert Murdoch use his billions to lie to us, but we can't use the billions that progressives have.
I think that we need to talk to some wealthy progressives about that, number one. But number two, the fact of the matter is that war is very profitable. And when you've changed the rules of the game so that a giant defense contractor like General Electric can own a network like NBC, guess what? 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Harry Craig scares me, the senator from Idaho. All his Republican buddies are telling him he's gotta go. You see, they think that being gay is some kind of disgrace. All around the Senate and the House, they make that case. The fact is, they've got enormous closet space, and that scares me. Dick Cheney scares me with those beady eyes. They get intense and glary every time he lies, which is like every day now. He's got a machine where his heart should be, just pumping out an evil philosophy. He shoots people in the face and gets away scot-free, and he scares me. Ann Coulter scares me, and now I gotta be blunt. In my frank opinion, she's just a stupid pundit. And in the time of my day, she isn't worth a tick, 'cause she's nothing but a carny with a hate-filled shtick. But she sold a couple million books, and that's just sick. She scares me. But wait a minute.
Nine minutes before the hour. Welcome back, my friends.
Up there on Capitol.
TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Richard in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Am I on?
You are on the air.
Hey, Tom. I love your show. I like the way you engage the opposition, you know, our opposition, that is. At any rate, I've been calling Republican senators all day just to kind of as a strategy for maybe change, because, you know, Hagel is jumping ship. Seems like Warner's jumping ship. You know, Grassley, a lot of these guys, or Lugar.
Norm Coleman is running scared. From Al Franken, frankly.
Right, exactly. And, you know, the thing is we need to change Republican minds in this country. And so the pressure needs to be put on these senators to remind them, you know, the emperor has no more clothes. It's time to give it up.
And very, very well said, Richard.
That's what I've been doing the last couple of days is reminding them that they're on a sinking ship. Thanks for your time.
Good on you. Good on you. Yeah, thanks for the call, and it's great calling Republican senators. What a novel idea! No, it's something we all should be doing, particularly your senators, John in Washington D.C. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. You were talking earlier about taking our religion, Christianity, back from these right wingers, and I completely.
Yeah, I mean,
agree.
Here, let me just give you a little bit of Jerry Falwell. Rest in peace. I mean, you know, he's not with us anymore, but I mean, this is relatively recent.
You got to kill the terrorists before the killing stops, and I'm for the president. Chase them all over the world. If it takes 10 years, blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
Blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
Yeah, it's
that's not Christianity.
No, it's the Satan in the pulpits, and but my idea is all we have to do is start changing the words and make the basic prayer, for instance, the Lord's Prayer, well, for the word Lord and the word kingdom, I'm replacing those. I don't say your kingdom come anymore. I say your governance come.
Just so you think they're a little too hierarchical. But I think that's
coming from the King James Bible. The translations came over to America from old Europe, where they had all their kingdoms, they had all their lords and ladies,
right.
And we have never translated it in the American version, which should lords, ladies, and princes, and all that.
Yeah, okay. Good point, John. Good point. I find the New International Version, actually, is my favorite translation, of both the Old and New Testament, but you know, whatever. Bill in Tenasket, Washington. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tom. My point about this is I think we're going about this thing all wrong. I think, you know, we're all sitting around arguing whether this war is right or not. Let's just give them that the war is right. Let's just say that everything that they are saying is absolutely correct and that this war has the same importance and the same magnitude as World War II. During World War II, no one made money off of armaments. It was illegal to profit. Everyone was taxed at a higher rate. There was rationing. Everyone was drafted.
The very simple way that the Democrats could shut this entire thing down is to say to George W. Bush, okay, cool, you want $50 billion? No problem. Raise the taxes on the wealthy in America to pay for it, and put into place a draft so that everybody in the United States is going to have somebody participating in this war, and we'll give you all whatever you want as long as you pay for it. And I guarantee you the cowards in the Republican Party would back away so fast it would be a blur. Chris in Long Island, New York. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom. How are you? Good afternoon. Tom, I heard your comment before about those politicians who have never been in the heat of battle, being banging the drums the loudest. And I wanted to remind everybody that Rush Limbaugh, one of the talking heads, also didn't serve in Vietnam because he had an infected boil on his butt.
I'm not going to go there. I'm sorry. Dan, speaking as a talk show host himself, who did not serve in war. Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan, listening on KLSD.
Yeah, I wanted to, make a there's a difference between the chicken hawks of today and the warmongers of yesterday. And during Vietnam, the warmongers, at least, they were willing to go for the most part, if they were called up. They didn't go to such great lengths to get out of the draft. But if you look at the chicken hawks, not only are they saying rah, 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 the people who actually did do combat, they're calling them cowards, and they're also basking in the glory, bestowing heroism by proxy on themselves, like Giuliani, basking in the glory of firefighters.
Right.
I mean, it's just a
joke. You're absolutely right, Dan. And the thing with Giuliani, I was just amazed by this. People commenting about how iconic that photo of Giuliani walking down the street during 9/11 was, and how that's just burned into Americans' brains as a good picture. Whenever you see the picture, the TV footage of Giuliani walking down the street, what you have to remind yourself is that the reason he's walking down the street is because he had no place else to go, because his command center was blown up, because like an idiot and against the advice of everybody around him, he put it in the World Trade Center, his command center, and the guy who owned the World Trade Center then did a $100,000 fundraiser a week after the deal was signed for Giuliani on his private yacht. That's why Giuliani was walking down the streets in 9/11. It was because he had no command center to go to, because for a $100,000 campaign contribution, he put it in the World Trade Center. I mean, that meme needs to get out there. 57 minutes past here.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, back in 1978, Louise and I started working with an international relief organization based out of West Germany called Kinder- und Jugendhilfswerk-Salem. And this weekend is their 50th anniversary. So when I get off the air today, I'm hopping on a plane and flying over to Germany, and I'll be spending the next 3 days, or the next 5 days, actually, there. I'll be speaking at the 50th anniversary party. And working for that organization, I worked in Africa and Uganda during the war with Idi Amin, in Central and South America, and in Colombia, down in the Medellin Valley, and in Bogota, in Lima, Peru. We were there when the presidential palace, where they attempted to bomb it. In Australia, in other parts of Africa, in Russia, in Kaliningrad, some extensive stuff. Wrote a book about it, actually, about a lot of this stuff. And when I was living in East Germany, when I was living in the West Germany, rather, one of the towns that we lived in we lived a year there and in 86, 87, and spent a lot of time there, was a town called Hirchheim, which literally our backyard was the East German border. The border between East and West Germany. In the spring, as the sun would come up, it would warm up the fields, and the the soil would start to swell, and the landmines would go off. And that would wake you up in the morning, the sound of exploding landmine. Walk out in your backyard, and there's guys up in towers with guns pointed at you. So my question for Joseph Farah. Joseph Farah is with us. He's the founder, editor, and CEO of WorldNet Daily and the author of Stop the Presses, the Inside Story of the Media Revolution, the website worldnetdaily.com, a great conservative website for news and commentary. First of all, Joseph, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom, and God bless you for those relief, that relief work you did all over the world at that time. But
well, thank you. Thank you.
I think I see where you're going with this East Germany analogy.
Yeah, let me just say, by the way, that I did that stuff for 25 years and actually continue to some small extent now, because it was the most, not because I, you know, had some great altruistic streak, but because it was the most interesting and fun thing I could think of to do. Going into a war zone and helping people not starve to death seemed to me like a great thing to do, like a fun thing to do. I'm always suspicious of people who say, oh, I'm doing it because I want to go to heaven. You know, spare me. Mm-hmm. But in any case, you know where I'm going with this thing. When did we become East Berlin? Duncan Hunter writing on your site, Jerome Corsi, about let's build a wall between us and Mexico. Why should we imitate the old Soviet Union and North Korea?
Well, because we're not imitating them at all. Those fences were meant to keep people in their countries. Every other border fence in the world, Tom, and having been around the world, you know there are many, many fences. Many countries take their borders very seriously. Most of those fences, like the one we propose for along the Mexican border, is meant to keep people out, to make sure to make sure that the people who enter our country. And by the way, we expect people to enter our country from Mexico every single day. We expect them to enter legally so we know who's coming in. Every other country in the world, Tom, as you well know, uses this standard practice. There isn't a country in the world that wants people to come in illegally. And that's why all of them have fences. Why you think the U.S. should be different? You know, you guys on Air America, the ones always saying we should imitate all the other countries in the world. Why is it that when it comes to building fences and having secure borders, we should be the only country in the world that doesn't?
Okay, I have interesting point and an interesting question, Joseph. First of all, you and I share the goal of eliminating illegal immigration in the United States.
Good.
You know, let's just put that right up front. And I've written about this at length. I view the hiring of illegal immigrants in the United States and the encouraging of that hiring by the Bush administration, by corporate America, as a way of breaking the back of labor and diminishing the strength of the middle class in America. And you know, that is an area where, you know, in principle, I suspect that probably you and I, and frankly, progressives historically agree. The first protests against illegal immigration were in the 1880s by the Wobblies and by progressives who were working on the railroads against the railroads importing Chinese labor into the United States to break strikes.
Well, you know, but today it's the Teamsters are leading the charge right now.
I know. But the point is, you asked about, you said this is standard practice. I have traveled all through South America. I have traveled from country to country. In Africa, I've traveled from country to country. In the Indian subcontinent, near Kashmir, through Pakistan, across parts of Asia, I have never encountered a fence.
In Pakistan, you never saw the fence between Pakistan and India.
There is not a fence that extends the entire border of Pakistan and India. Come on.
What's that?
There's not a fence that extends that entire border.
Well, I haven't walked the entire border, but I've seen some pretty amazing structures that separate the population.
Now, the fact of the matter is that in most places, there, you know, where you have countries that have military conflicts, sure, I'll grant you that there are military, you know, like North and South Korea, that there are militarized areas. But the way that countries, and you see this all over the world, and I went through this. I mean, I lived in Germany for a year. I had to go through the process of becoming a legal immigrant in another country. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, it wasn't easy. It took 6 months, and I had to jump through a million hoops. And it's the same thing here. My sister-in-law is in the process of becoming a U.S. citizen. She's been working on it for 4 years. And I think that that's appropriate, right? But the point is that most countries in the world don't say we're going to stop people from illegally immigrating into our country by putting up a fence. They do it by saying if anybody comes to this country and they want to work here and they're not a citizen, they don't have the right to work, and their employer goes to jail if they hire them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm in favor of that, too. But, see, we've been talking...
Then you don't need a fence.
Tom, we've been talking about these solutions for 30 years in this country, and there's absolutely...
Right, ever
no
since
action.
Reagan's amnesty. I mean, Reagan kicked the doors open on this thing. Reagan basically said, yeah, come on in. We want to bust labor as badly as we can in the United States, declared war against organized labor with his busting the PATCO strike and, you know, his amnesty in 86.
Tom,
and
do you
ever
in
since
democracy? Do you believe in democracy?
What's the point, Joseph?
The point is, 85% of the American people agree with me, and only 15% agree with you. Listen, if there's
agree with whom about what? By the way, the only fence in India is is on the Kashmiri border between Pakistan and India, and it's 340 miles long,
okay,
and it's not,
you know,
and they're not, it's not finished.
There are no two countries in the world that have a contiguous border like Mexico and the U.S. that have different
languages. Oh, sure, there are.
That
China and India.
That could be more. That, you know, there are no two countries that have, you know, less similarities between the populations. Language.
If you add up all the borders of all the European countries, you know, not to mention the Eastern European countries and Russia, you'll find, you know, by and large, except for cases where you have two countries that are experiencing military conflict, like India and Pakistan are right now over Kashmir, you don't have militarized areas. What you have is internal protections against the exploitation, frankly, of labor.
All right, I'll tell you what. If you can impose your solution quickly and put those employer sanctions in place, I'll give you 1 year to see if it gets done and it does the job, and we'll put a moratorium on the fence. How do you like that?
You know, it worked for 150 years, Joe.
Well,
Joseph,
where are your you know, representatives in Congress taking this action? Why
I don't speak for the Democratic Party. First of all, I mean, I wish I could, but I don't.
Listen, all I'm saying is the American people want action. It is the quality of life.
But the question is why? Here's the question: the American people want action because they perceive people coming to this country to work illegally as deteriorating the cost of labor in the United States,
no,
and that's something the guys on your side are all in favor of.
It's not just that. What do you mean, guys on my side? Who are the guys?
I mean, conservatives hate organized labor.
There's nobody in Washington on my side. Nobody. Okay, but let me tell you why the American people see the deterioration of the quality of life. It's not just the jobs. The jobs are a big part of it. But they see when they go to the grocery store, they see men hanging out on the street corners waiting to be picked up for jobs. They see graffiti all over suburban neighborhoods, not just urban neighborhoods, everywhere. You can escape it from Maine to Washington State.
Well, why don't you write an op-ed? You can find mine, by the way. If you go over to TomHartmann.com and just click on Articles on Democracy, you'll find several articles that I've written there about this topic, about, you know, this. Why don't you write an article also? We'll together call for any CEO of any corporation in America that is hiring illegals to be thrown in jail, period. No amnesty, no three strikes, you're out, one strike and you're out, and let's see what happens.
Hey, we're on it. Let's put together a coalition.
Okay.
Like
Joseph Farah. He's the founder, editor, and CEO of WorldNet Daily and author of Stop the Presses, the inside story of the new media revolution, WorldNetDaily.com. Joseph, thanks for coming on the program
today.
Thank
you, Tom. God bless.
Ditto. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Here's the issue. Every time somebody uses, and I did in the last segment and shouldn't have, every time somebody uses the phrase illegal immigration, they're playing into a Karl Rove frame. We do not have an illegal immigration problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem. That's the absolute bottom line. It's just that simple. David Ricardo, one of the most famous economists in history, back in 1814, published a treatise. It was called On Labor. And in that, he said that when labor markets are tight, wages go up. And when labor markets are awash in workers willing to work at the bottom of the pay scale, the entire labor market will go down. And, you know, Republicans get this. Right? Reagan got this. In the 1980s, when the conservatives declared war on working people in the United States, because and they did it because they looked at what was happening in the 1960s and 70s, which was the time when, in the entire 200-year history of the United States at that time, when the middle class had the greatest level of wealth and power. It was that middle class, it was that broad middle class that Jefferson had envisioned. When that happened, what happened? The middle class started saying no to the traditional ruling class. You had African Americans saying, "Hey, wait a minute, what happened to civil rights?" You have women saying, "No, we're not. You know, we want to be equal in the workplace." We had gays saying, "Hey, what about us? We're part of the human family." We had people of all types stepping forward who had been marginalized in society and saying, "No, we will not be marginalized anymore." You had young people saying, "Hell no, I'm not going to go after that war." And the conservatives looked at this and said, "This is terrible. We can't have the average person having this much economic power because it gives them political power." The top 1% of Americans, in terms of owning wealth, the top 1% of Americans owned about 15% of all wealth in the United States. 15% of all wealth in the United States back in the 1920s. It was down to only 6% in the 1960s. It's back up to around 15%. So what had happened was there had been this huge shift of wealth from the elites to the middle class during the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And they were unwilling to put up with that. Got to destroy the middle class. And so an organized war was declared on the middle class in the United States. And so-called illegal immigration is actually a very small piece of it. The largest part of it was turning the Labor Department, which is supposed to protect the interests of labor, into the anti-labor department under Reagan, and it's stayed that way pretty much ever since. Changing the laws, expanding Taft-Hartley, making it more and more difficult for people to unionize, and changing our trade laws so that companies that didn't want to employ people here could employ people in China to do the same thing. But one piece of it was Reagan's 1986 amnesty and this process of just no longer enforcing employment laws. As the Washington Post noted in an article by Hu and Leiderson in June 19, 2006, between 1999 and 2003, now this is as the Bush administration came in, these gung-ho Republicans, worksite enforcement operations were scaled back 95% by the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which subsequently was merged into the Homeland Security Department. The number of employers prosecuted for unlawfully employing immigrants dropped from 182 employers in 1999 to, guess how many in 2003? Only 4. And fines collected dropped from $3.6 million in 1999 to $212,000, according to federal statistics. In 1999, we initiated fines against 417 companies. In 2004, we issued fine notices against 3 companies. This is an illegal employer problem. It's not an illegal immigration problem. We need immigration into the United States. We need rational immigration policies. We need rational immigration policies that provide for people from all over the world to come here and live in the United States. It's been one of our traditional strengths. As I said, my sister-in-law, my wife's brother's wife, is here from another country working to become a U.S. citizen. I've, you know, up front and close and personal, I've seen this problem. I had to write out testimony for the INS. Yes, they're actually married. Yes, they do love each other. I mean, you know, I've been through it. I've seen it. And I've been through it in other countries. And every other country in the world. In Mexico, you go down to Mexico and you go to work for somebody without permission from the government, they'll throw your butt in jail or they'll deport you. I mean, every country controls their labor force, it protects their labor force with rules like this. It's very simple stuff. And we need to, frankly, I think we need to expand our immigration programs, and we need to let more people in. But we need to do it in an organized fashion, not in the, hey, if you're willing to work, come on in. Because that's what it's boiled down to. And it has just played into the further destruction of the American middle class. And not only that, it plays right into the hands of the right-wing racists who they're brown people. They're, you know, we got to be very hysterical about that. And so you've got this coalition of racists and people who see that the middle class is vanishing, don't know why, but they think this has something to do with it, who are forming on the right, and people on the left going, well, I'm not sure how we should talk about this. What's politically correct today? 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. It's like everything and nothing leads to wisdom. It's like no one really meant what they meant. It's like every man's a king, every house a kingdom. It's like Joe McCarthy was our acting president. Everything's A-OK in the USA, in the good old USA. Everything's A-OK in the USA.
Well, we're going to make it that way anyway. 34 minutes past the hour, 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, toll-free nationwide, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com. Check it out. Sandra in Berkeley, California. Hey, Sandra, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I've been on before, but it's good to always talk to you. You're brilliant. Thank you. Keep it up. I'm sure you know. You know, I remember hearing, and I could be wrong, that Clinton started a program that was a computerized program that any time that an employer hired an employee, it went through the system, and if it didn't match up with stuff, they sent a little letter back to the employee or saying, you know, this something is wrong with this Social Security, could you please check it? And
right.
Either the employee, it was like a hint to the employer that if it was an illegal alien, they better fire him, or otherwise
right.
prove that it was real. And I heard that when the Bush administration took over, they got rid of this great system.
That's right.
You know?
So, broadly speaking, yeah. And that was you know, the AP story that I was just, or the Washington Post story that I was sharing with you, that, you know, enforcement actions were scaled back dramatically by the Bush administration. And
right.
And the reason why is very, very simple. They want to try and break the back of labor. And you know, again, I'm not opposed to immigration. I'm not opposed to immigration from Mexico or anywhere else, although I would say that there are some parts of the world where there are genuine disasters going on. The second largest refugee crisis in the world is in Iraq. How many Iraqis are we taking in as refugees? I think that, you know, we should allow a lot of immigration from Iraq. The first largest refugee problem in the world is in Darfur, in Sudan. We're not, you know, we need to be a place of refuge, I in my opinion. Plus, you know, there are decent people around the world who'd like to become citizens of the United States. But not in a way, let's not do it in a way and for the purpose of destroying the cost of labor in the United States. And that's the way it's been done ever since Reagan. Mo in San Diego, California. Hey, Mo.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Tom. To me, you know, the Republicans are a hypocrite. You know, they just, you know, Hezbollah, they care about the party. The only reason they don't like Mexicans is because they are potential Democrats.
It may well be, although, you know, there's down in Mexico, a conservative was just elected president, Calderon.
But I said those who migrate to California, they are potentially Democrats. And regarding the legal, you know, immigration, these people, they can pick and choose legal immigrants. They can go and check their backgrounds. If they have any potential of being, you know, Democrat, they're not going to get a visa. And these people, they have a potential to be, you know, Republican, and they're very conservative, and they get a visa, and they're being picked and choose. And that's legal immigration.
Yeah, interesting. Mo, thanks a lot for the contribution. Carol in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Carol.
Hey, Tom. I love your show, and keep up the good work. I live in a little suburb of Seattle, and I've lived here about 25 years, and it was about 10 years it was getting real depressed. The business is closed, hookers on the street. It was pretty bad. And then I can't say if they're Mexican, but Spanish-speaking people started moving into the area, opening up empty, you know, places of business for their own, you know, music and DVDs and food. And the hookers aren't here anymore.
In other words, the immigrants have improved your town. They've made life better.
They've improved the community in a way that I never would have expected. And just the other day, a Spanish-speaking person came to the door and asked if I'd go to a meeting to help clean up the pollution in the Duwamish River.
Yeah, I mean, this is great. So this is the history of rational immigration in the United States. The Irish, you know, the first wave of Irish immigration after the potato famine in the 1840s, as I recall, into Massachusetts. At the first generation, they were reviled, frankly, by many people on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. By the second generation, or as that wave of immigration was maturing, they, you know, took over the political levels of power in Boston. The Italian immigrants into New York and into parts of Pennsylvania.
Wow.
Same thing. It's like what you see with immigration is a good thing, and having immigrants come into this country, I think, is a good thing. I'm just concerned that it be done in a way that is rational and doesn't destroy the interests of labor, frankly, in the United States. That we say, okay, how many jobs are there available in this country? X. Let's say there's 100 million jobs available. So that means if there's 100 million jobs available, ideally we want to have 100 million people willing to work. Because if we have 101 million people willing to work, then the cost of labor is going to start to fall because people are going to be competing more aggressively for those jobs. Or if we had 99 million people, you know, with 100 million jobs, then employers would have to compete for the employees and you'd see the price of labor go up. And that's what happened. That is why progressives fought to have child labor laws put into place. It wasn't because they were concerned about the fate of children, although that's how it was sold. It was because they didn't want children competing with adults in the workplace. And child labor laws, when they were passed in the United States, diminished the size of the workforce, and by doing so drove up the cost of labor, and by doing so helped bring about a middle class. I mean, it's oddly enough, I mean, this is what unions are about. This is what these kind of rules are about. It's about limiting the supply of labor to a level that roughly matches the demand for labor. When the supply of labor exceeds the demand for labor, then the price of labor crashes through the floor. This is David Ricardo, 1814, Econ 101. And, you know, this is not rocket science. Rick in Sacramento, California. Hey, Rick.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Tom. I get really pissed off when I start hearing people talking about putting up walls and along the borders, because the fundamental assumption is that the problem is they're crossing the border illegally. No, the more fundamental question is, why did they cross the border in the first place? If it wasn't for deals like CAFTA, NAFTA, World Trade Organization, World Bank, whatever, and it causes a lot of problems in countries where they want to come here and work, because I have no problem with a guy that wants to come here and earn money for his family and keep himself and live the American dream like we do. They don't
sure, we're all human beings. We can empathize with them. But the fact of the matter is that between U.S. policies, actually multinational corporate policies, because that's what drove NAFTA, between these policies and things like our subsidies for corn in the United States, which are wiping out peasant farmers, you know, small farmers in Mexico and other Central American countries, between those things and the exportation now from Mexico of jobs to China as a result of the World Trade Organization. I mean, you know, GM was moving all those factories down to Mexico. There's a whole strip of areas in Mexico where there used to be factories from the United States, and now they've moved all those manufacturing over to China. And when China's price of labor gets up to a certain point, they'll start moving them someplace else. They'll say, okay, where's the next impoverished country in the world? And at some point, we need to say no. We need to say no, enough. We're not going to let this happen. Bill in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Bill.
Hey. The power to stop illegal immigration in this country already exists, and it resides in the hands of the IRS. Every time someone fills out a W-2 in this country and puts a false Social Security number on it, or the Social Security number of a dead person, or the Social Security number of a woman when it's a male applicant, all the IRS has to do is see that number, send a letter to the employer, and inform that they have an illegal person working for them. They have 30 to 90 days to correct that paperwork error, if that's what it is, or they have to terminate the employment of that person.
That's my point, exactly. And you know who was pushing for that kind of enforcement before Reagan in 1980 was the labor unions. When Reagan came into office, we had about 20, I think when he was inaugurated, 25% of all American workers were members of unions. The peak of unionization had been about 15 years before that at 35%. If you have a union job, there's typically another job in the community that has the same benefits and wages, because the union job sets the floor. So half of all American workers had the equivalent of a good union job. And those were the people who were saying, we are going to enforce these immigration laws and we're in order to protect ourselves, in order to protect labor. It's all about labor. And you know, as I said, Reagan went after that. Reagan took it apart. It's all about the war on the middle class. George in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, George.
Hey, Tom, good to talk to you. Listen, I think one of the biggest strategic mistakes that that labor ever made in the 1980s was the Airline Pilots Association, of which I used to be a member before I retired, not supporting the PATCO strike.
Yep.
Because exactly what happened was that gave, when Reagan was able to pull that baloney off, that gave a green flag to people like Frank Lorenzo to bust his unions within the airline.
Yep. That was the beginning of the end of labor in this country. And, I mean, you know, they're slowly creeping back now, although what they really need is you know, the card check law, the Employee Free Choice Act. And I was just astounded when Congress passed that. And then Bush says, no, ain't going to happen. And Congress is like, okay, all right, we're not going to fight about it. But you're absolutely right, George. And the busting the PATCO strike was the kickoff for Reagan. And a terrible thing for it. Tony in Queens, New York. Hey, Tony.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Just wanted to comment. I'm Hispanic American. I came here legally back in 1966 from Cuba. But insofar as the Republican Party is concerned, with this issue of immigration, it's really a win-win situation for them, because the president, we all know, supports companies and corporations who benefit from the illegal immigration, and yet the Republican Party as a whole can take a step sideways and say, oh, this is a big issue, we oppose immigration, and they
and they're playing the race card, basically.
That's my point. They play the race card, and you know what? Sadly, a quarter of this country, they have that latent inside of them. It doesn't matter whether they're Republican or Democrat. That earlier call you had, the truck driver, he actually is a Democrat, but you see that in him, he had that worry of losing jobs.
It goes beyond. Tony, thank you for the call. We've got to take a break here, but you're right, and I think the tragedy is that a quarter of America is racist, whether they recognize it or not, and an even greater tragedy is that an entire political party has decided to exploit it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Bill O'Reilly finally found a home when Fox News came along. The main fact on the factor is the facts are often wrong. Slander those who can't defend themselves without an ounce of shame. Make everything about himself, and that's how he became.
Vicious, and that is with a capital V, person who's blinded by ideology.
You might be someone who'll dig it. You might be O'Reilly's kind, especially if you're a bigot with a closed and tiny mind.
Shut up!
If you have no use for reason, then you'll love the way he acts. And he'll tell you what you want to hear, regardless of the facts.
They're not facts.
Bill O'Reilly finally found a home when Fox News came along. A place he could ignore the truth and get the facts all wrong. Faced with the truth he can't refute, then he'll call you a name.
You're a lunatic.
He'll thumb his nose, the legend goes that that's how he became.
A snide, condescending idiot.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Radner on the line with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Shana Tova, Ellen.
Well, thank you so much. I'm actually on the train. I just left the belly of the beast. I guess the thing that amazed me yesterday, in addition to the map that I talked to you about, was right after I got off the air, I went back in, and there was none other than Senator Lieberman. And he posed the question to General Petraeus. Well, there are training camps in Iran. So is there any thought, essentially, to go into Iran to root them out? Nobody picked up on that. And to me, that was the most amazing question of the day.
Well, that's interesting. And what was the answer to the question?
Well, the answer was is that that was not part of the mission,
right.
Which it isn't. And obviously, Petraeus...
Do we know that there are training camps in Pakistan, but do we know that there are, quote, terrorist training camps in Iran? I mean, is there any evidence of that?
Well,
is Joe Lieberman just calling
question.
This out of...
And we don't know. I mean, clearly some of those newfangled, roadside bombs are coming out of there. There's no question about that. I don't totally disagree with that. Some probably are. But training camps, I don't know, and he wasn't really asked that question. However, it is interesting that crazy Senator Inhofe, and that guy, I'm telling you, he's way out there. He starts talking about Salman Pak and how now there's no terrorist training camps that there were before Saddam, and I mean it was way, way out there. In addition, the administration has Condoleezza Rice out, and this is right, of course, as the president will be speaking to the country tomorrow night. Now, it's also interesting that I asked today's Tony Snow's last day briefing, and I asked Tony this morning about Senator Lieberman's question, and Tony said he doesn't answer hypothetical questions, and that the press, meaning people like me, even though I'm a friend of Tony's, love to ask hypothetical questions. But I wasn't asking a hypothetical question. I was asking about what Senator Lieberman asked.
Mm-hmm. But still he wouldn't answer the question.
He definitely would not answer the question.
Yeah. Interesting.
Couple other interesting things going on. Senator Craig is actually going to be going to court for reversal of his charge. That's going to be happening September 26th. And today, Wendy Ellis Cortez had a press conference outside of David Vitter's office in the Senate and said that she had a relationship with him from July to November 99. Now, she said she has nothing to prove it, but Larry Flint claims that he has a polygraph test to prove that she is not that she's not lying about it. And
right.
There's a very interesting hearing, sort of political, but definitely interesting, going on today in the Senate. Apparently, we import $22 billion, that's with a B, toys from China. And they had three panels today. The third one is the Toys R Us CEO and the Mattel CEO. The Mattel CEO said that they have all kinds of testing, et cetera, going on in China, but somehow the lead paint slipped through their fingers. And one of the senators said that she had Minnesota. I murder the English language. Sorry about that. One of her constituents, a four-year-old, died from swallowing a piece of jewelry, not from choking, but from having four times the amount of lead in their body. Senator Brownback wants to stop all imports from China. Toys in from China to the United States. He said that's the only way China will pay attention. And although I hate to ever support Senator Brownback because I think he's another one in the loony right, he stopped clock right twice a day, and he may have that one right.
Yeah, yeah. And this is just another indication, another example of how, A, capitalism and democracy have nothing in common. They don't necessarily follow each other. We're seeing capitalism in Russia being followed by Putin today, dissolving the government, and moving in a far more authoritarian direction. And in communist China, you've got a communist government that kills people, that is one of the biggest boosters of capitalism in the world. We need to put to bed this myth that capitalism somehow always leads to democracy. What leads to democracy is democracy.
Well, that's right. That's right. And I mean, if it's market economies, then, which is what the Bush administration used to say at the beginning, that market economies mean freedom. Well, that's just not the case. Just one other thing that the press did not pick up on. And when I was at the briefing this morning, I discussed this with several members of the press. So we'll see if anybody asks it in this or asked it this afternoon's briefing about those two of the seven soldiers who died in Iraq, who wrote that piece for the New York Times. And it was called The War as We Saw It. Sergeant Mora and Sergeant Gray died in a vehicle accident today in Iraq.
Yeah, all the more the tragedy. Ellen Radner with TalkRadioNews.com, Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Ellen, thank you for the report.
Thank you.
And Happy New Year. Have a great holiday. Have a great weekend.
Thank you so much.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. By the way, the last bumper from thatguitarman.com. And tomorrow, Friday, and Monday, Peter B. Collins, Laura Flanders, and Sam Cedar will be filling in for me. Coming up next, Corey Powell.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Climate change. A lot of people think of climate change, global warming. Oh, gee, it'll open the Arctic to shipping. It'll mean that the winters aren't so bad. Yeah, that would be fine. I can go along with that. You know, it's no problem. The International Institute for Strategic Studies, the IISS, this is a security-based think tank. The IISS has just released a report talking about global warming and its consequences. And what they're saying is this is not at all what you thought it was going to be. Instead, it's going to be a disaster. It's just going to be an absolute bleeping disaster. They're talking this from Reuters, from London. Climate change could have global security implications on a par with nuclear war unless urgent action is taken, a report said on Wednesday. The ISSS, International Institute for IISS, excuse me, for Strategic Studies, security think tank, said global warming could hit crop yields and water availability everywhere, causing great human suffering and leading to regional strife. While everyone had now started to recognize the threat posed by climate change, no one was taking effective leadership to tackle it. No one could tell precisely when and where it would hit hardest, this report added. And here's a quote from the report. The most recent international moves toward combating global warming represent a recognition that if the emission of greenhouse gases is allowed to continue unchecked, the effects will be catastrophic on the level of, now get this, on the level of nuclear war. They say even if the international community succeeds in adopting comprehensive and effective measures to mitigate climate change, there will still be unavoidable impacts from global warming on the environment, economies, and human security. This is why, you know, frankly, I think it's so important that we take really seriously this stuff. Leonardo DiCaprio's movie, The 11th Hour, Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, the many books that are being written on this topic. I mean, this is stuff that we cannot any longer not take seriously. Nuclear war? They're saying global warming is going to have a consequence identical to that of nuclear war? This is serious stuff. I mean, what kind of world are we going to leave to the next generation? What kind of world, for that matter, may we be experiencing ourselves in our own lifetimes? these massive melts that are happening right now in the Arctic and the Antarctic. Greenland, the glaciers going 10 times faster than the models had predicted. I mean, massive chunks of ice going now into it. And what happens if this ice, from particularly from Greenland, this fresh water, starts to contaminate the North Atlantic to desalinate it, to reduce its salinity, and thus shuts down this thousand-year current, the stream that brings, that we call the Gulf Stream as it passes the United States, that brings warm water up into the North Atlantic that causes Europe to be temperate. Global warming could create an ice age in Europe. And the Europeans are quite aware of this, by the way, and quite concerned about it. But we seem to be, what's the big deal? Let's just go along. Go along and get along, and no problem. Yeah, we really need to be taking this stuff seriously. So anyhow, I wanted to point that out. Also, just a few things here in the news. The percentage of New Orleans' black population after Hurricane Katrina has declined by 36%. I'm guessing, Karl Rove and friends at the White House are high-fiving each other. This is an ongoing disaster. An economic forecast by UCLA predicts that the nation's economy will be so sluggish well into next year that any major hiccup could tip it into a recession. And this was the screaming headlines all over the Economist and other publications like that, that, you know, we're looking at really serious, serious economic problems as a consequence of 26 years of pretty much nonstop conservative economic philosophy and policies that were goosed, just, you know, simply goosed by and large by Federal Reserve policies, stimulating a stock market bubble and stimulating a housing bubble, and massive amounts of borrowing. Reagan, Bush Sr., and Bush Jr. collectively, between the three of them, borrowed 40% of all the money that all presidents in the history of the United States have borrowed, just three presidents, and spent it to stimulate the economy, to make it look like there was actually a decent economy when, in fact, there wasn't. I mean, that's how bad it is. So we talked about a lot today. There's a lot on the table. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, Jim in Berkeley. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tom. Subject did come up finally. I'm really glad about it during the last half hour with one of the callers. I told the screener I was calling to disagree with you. I'm really, I suppose, more calling to take you to task a bit for not discussing the full picture when immigration comes up. And the part that seems to get dropped, whenever I listen to you talk about it, is what is pushing people across the borders to the United States to get jobs, which is underdevelopment and grinding poverty in the countries that they're coming from. And no,
sure, absolutely.
Immigration
and,
is ever going to deal with the problem unless and until that's addressed really first and foremost.
Yeah, the hyper-imperialistic policies of the United States have been very, very destructive in South and Central America. No doubt about it. And
Anglo-American colonialism, stripping the resources and decimating the economies of those areas, too.
Sure, sure. And I would submit to you that Calderon would not be president of Mexico right now, that Morales would be president of Mexico right now, if most of the people... Well, there's that, too. I agree with you that the election was stolen. But if many of the people who were the most likely to be activists, the most likely to be progressive, the most likely to take action, and they demonstrate that by the fact that they're willing to take their lives in their hands to cross the border to come to the United States, had still been in Mexico. I think that we are harming their political system, and also by basically pulling, you know, what may well be the cream of the crop of people who are potential political activists into the United States. And so, just right across the board, I don't think it helps the United States. It doesn't help Mexico. It only helps transnational corporations and the employers in this country. Thanks for the call, Richard in Oakland, California. Hey, Richard.
Oh yeah, in the hour when you had Mr. Podoritz on,
right?
You mentioned that his influence on foreign policy goes back to the 70s. Well, I think it's still going on now because his son-in-law, of course, is Elliot Abrams.
Right.
Who was
convicted during Iran-Contra and is now working in the Bush administration.
On Israel, Palestine, and Iran specifically.
Yeah, yeah. No, so you point made. And as I said when I interviewed him, these guys were wrong with the Committee for the Present Danger, and they were wrong about Iraq, and now they're saying we should attack Iran immediately. Come on. Ashley in Long Beach, California. Hey, Ashley, what's up? Ashley?
Did you say Ashley?
I did. You're on the air.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm on the freeway, so it's a little hard to hear. I just wanted to say that all of these, like Reagan's economic policies and Bush's economic policies, all been paved. The way was paved by Nixon in 1971 when he took our currency off the gold standard. And if you look at an inflation chart since 1913, you know, the inflation kind of goes on a sideways trajectory until 1971. And without a precious metals-backed currency, there's nothing to hold the banks from massively inflating.
And right, or to hold the Fed from massively inflating. Yeah, or both. Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you at all. Doug in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Hey, I'm curious that it sounds to me like every single problem we face in the world today is somehow the Bush administration and the Republicans' fault.
No, actually, I would submit to you that probably most of the problems that the middle class are confronting right now in the United States have to do with policies put into place by Bill Clinton, specifically NAFTA and GATT, although the Republicans were gung-ho enthusiastic for it.
Well, some were.
I am not a partisan on these issues, Doug. The Democratic Party doesn't agree with me on immigration. The Democratic Party, by and large, doesn't agree with me on trade policy. Neither does the Republican Party, frankly, because I'm taking the old-fashioned progressive positions rather than the modern Republican or Democratic positions. And frankly, I think I'm right, and I think they're wrong.
Well, you know what? I'm happy to hear someone who can admit that, you know, sometimes there's just an honest disagreement as opposed
sure.
to somebody's a liar or somebody's a crook or there's some evil plot afoot. So
yeah, no, I don't see an evil plot. I would be the first to say, and I've said it many times, Doug, I believe that a lot of these people, a lot of conservatives, most conservatives, in fact, believe that their policies are going to be the very best thing for America. I think they're wrong, but they believe that their policies are going to be the best thing for America. And when historically you look at what has happened when the country has been governed by people who believe in those economic policies, conservative economic policies, you find that the middle class gets wiped out and the very wealthy rule. And there are conservatives who will come right out and tell you, you know, William F. Buckley at the front of the list, read Russell Kirk's book, read Buckley's commentaries, that we need a ruling elite in the United States. That's what they're all about. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Well, tell that to Alberto. Tell that to Faux News. 21 minutes past the hour. Oh, welcome back. I heard about a boycott. There's a KLSD radio station, progressive radio station down in San Diego, California, and a bunch of folks got together and went out, declared a day for a boycott, and went out to advertisers on the radio station and walked into the shops and bought things and specifically said, we're here because we support the radio station that you're advertising on. Good on you. And I heard about this. I wanted to get on one of the guys who was involved in putting this thing together. Aldous Tyler is with us. He's with nonstopradio.com. Hey, Aldous, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So this is so cool. Instead of protesting and things, I mean, we have to acknowledge progressive talk radio, any kind of political talk radio for that matter, is a business first and foremost. It's not going to be responsive to, you know, protests and demonstrations. It's going to be responsive to other business, you know, to economics. And you guys are doing the thing that is going to push economics in a positive way, if I understand this correctly.
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely, Tom. The thing that most people need to remember is that while obviously this is a vital resource for the truth and to make sure that liberal and progressive views have a place on the air, how it gets there is the commerce. And frankly, one of the things that we've been able to find out is that progressive talk is an excellent vehicle for advertisement for commercial ventures. It's just the place to do it.
Right. In fact, I come back from a break and I'll say, you know, this is listener supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. So what happened down in San Diego? What was being done down there?
Well, okay. Right now, what we've got is this past weekend they started what's called the boycott, as you mentioned, and they are going around to every single sponsor they can find for KLSD and thanking them personally for sponsoring the station, specifically for sponsoring Progressive Talk on the station, and asking them to join in the effort to keep Progressive Talk on KLSD.
Right, and this is something that I, you know, is right across the board for, you know, any affiliate. I mean, no matter how successful they are or how much on the edge they may be, all of our radio stations. This is absolutely great. The listeners getting together, getting organized, and getting out there to support the stations. It's and also, you know, the other thing that I would hope comes out of this, and you can tell me, Aldous, you know, do a reality check, is that we would get more sponsors that are more consonant with our message.
Well, absolutely. And the thing to keep in mind is that, you know, again, San Diego, it's about a 50-50 when it comes to political issues. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, as far as conservative and liberal. But, you know, the fact is that it's a metro area of millions of people. 50% of millions is still, well, millions. That's a lot
right.
of people who buy cars, who buy peanut butter, who buy T-shirts. You buy peanut butter, don't you, Tom?
Sure I do. I like crunchy. Louise likes smooth, so
exactly.
You have to buy both.
Grocers need to make sure that they're advertising where you'll hear them. You know, it's the same way for everybody else. So I wanted to make sure to get this out here real quick, too. Apparently, the Rubios at Mira Mesa in San Diego is going to have Ralph Rubio, the founder there himself, around 10 a.m. Pacific, handing out coupons. And Rubio's has been a supporter of KLSD for quite some time. So a very focused boycott is being asked for right then to go there and thank Ralph Rubio, the founder of Rubio's, for being a supporter of Progressive Talk in San Diego.
There you go. And not just in San Diego, but all across the country. If you know of a, you know, whenever you shop someplace, you have an opportunity. If it's a shop that you like, if it's a company that, you know, you can talk to somebody who has some influence, just say, hey, you should be advertising on Progressive Talk Radio. You should become part of the solution here. And mostly because it's going to get you a good upscale demographic. It's going to get you a lot of listeners. It's going to get your message out. It's going to make you money. But also, you know, you're supporting a social good. Aldous, I think it's absolutely great what you're doing. People can learn all about it over at nonstopradio.com. Great website. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Tom, I have time for one more thing.
Sure.
Yeah, this just came in my email box literally as we were talking. There is a second rally to save KLSD forming 7:30 to 9 a.m. on Friday at the Clear Channel offices there in San Diego. And, yes, that'll be up on my site in a second.
Okay, great. You can learn about that at nonstopradio.com. But as I said, at the bottom line, radio stations are businesses, and they respond not to protests. They respond to revenue. That's
exactly
what we've got to do. Yeah, Aldous, thanks a lot for being on with us. It's good talking with you today, and I think it's great what you're doing. So let's see, 26 minutes past the hour. Noah in Modesto. Hey, we got about a half a minute here, Noah, before we take a break. What's up?
Just wanted to thank you, Tom, for putting on a really thought-provoking and well-researched show daily for us so that we have some kind of nourishment. I wanted to ask your take on the living wage. If the mm-hmm. living wage goes up, how would we adjust to the cost of goods and everything rising? What was your idea or opinion on that?
Yeah, well, the conservative argument is that if you have a minimum wage or a living wage, that's going to cause the cost of goods to go up, and it will slightly, but the cost, the price of labor will go up faster. So,
okay.
You know, I don't mind paying 5% more for my food if my paycheck is 10% larger.
And
when you do the math, when you look at how it filters through the economy, the cost of labor is only a small percentage of the cost of most goods and services, and particularly goods, products. And so increasing the cost of labor does not increase the cost of the product as much to the point that the laborers then are having to pay dramatically more for the product, right? In other words, the conservative logic breaks down when you analyze it. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
The market once made sense, but now something's off. It's since your secret meetings in Dick Cheney's office. Oh, Exxon, you just take and you take and keep taking, and your concern is a scam. Oh, Exxon, it's so clear from the profits you're making that you don't give a damn. Oh, Exxon, getting rich on the back of this nation and double use war. Oh, Exxon, keep on screwing.
Oh, Exxon, keep on screwing the next generation. Indeed, what a tragedy. Well, this from the new, from the wire services, as we like to say here, saying he was totally exhausted and drained. Former Senator, Tennessee Senator Fred Thompson withdrew from the race for the Republican presidential nomination today. Mr. Thompson's move surprised supporters and rivals alike, since the Tennessean had announced his candidacy less than 1 week earlier. But in his announcement, Mr. Thompson made it clear that the punishing schedule of a presidential campaign was not to his liking. He said, I'm putting in 7, sometimes 8-hour days, and that's not what I signed up for. When asked when he began having second thoughts about his decision to run for president, the former senator replied, I'd say halfway through my announcement on the Leno show, I could feel myself definitely fading. The erstwhile candidate said that his week on the campaign trail made him long for his days as an actor on the NBC series Law and Order. We'd go out there, find out there was a murder, and bam, an hour later, it's quitting time, he said. Davis Logsdon, chairman of the political science department at the University of Minnesota, offered this comment on Mr. Thompson's surprising decision. This should end the debate over whether Fred Thompson is lazy like a fox or just plain old lazy. For his part, Mr. Thompson scoffed when a reporter asked if he was departing the race to spend more time with his family. Oh, please, he said, that's even more exhausting than running for president. Right now, I just want a nap. Well, that, you know, whenever I say from the wire services, of course, it's from Andy Borowitz, the Borowitz Report. So, you know, that's tongue-in-cheek. Fred Thompson actually isn't resigning. But here's where it gets downright strange. This is the real news from, for example, the Washington Times. Fred Thompson had few significant legislative achievements during his 1994 to 2003 Senate tenure and established a reputation as a, quoting the Washington Times, less than hard worker. Again from the Washington Times, when pressed, he struggled to name his greatest achievements in the Senate. He said he managed the Homeland Security bill in the full Senate and added, there were a lot of things. Doesn't always have to do with putting your name on a piece of legislation. There's an awful lot of bad legislation I helped stop, for one thing. In reality, very few bills, little substance. In his years as a senator, Thompson did not see one substantial bill he introduced become law. A total of 5 minor measures he introduced became law, none in his final 2 years. This is like renaming a post office, 2 bills dealing with reports required to be sent to Congress, and 1 rearranging a component of the Tennessee Valley Authority, and a bill for the private relief of a single family facing an immigration problem. Newsweek profiling Thompson said, the senator has never been an enthusiastic politician. GOP elders in Tennessee had to plead with him to run for the Senate in 1994. Some close to him question whether moving to the White House is truly Thompson's life ambition or more the dream of his second wife, Jerry, a former GOP operative who is his unofficial campaign manager and top advisor. So, you know, Fred Thompson, lazy? I don't know. His high school, the quote next to his senior portrait in his high school yearbook, the lazier a man is, the more he plans to do tomorrow. So, interesting. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Chris in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi there, Tom. Great program, as always. Hey, listen, I recall you did a poll a few days ago, and I was really interested in those results, and I'm actually an Edwards supporter, and I'm in Texas, and I wanted to let you know that the Texas Democratic Party had an online poll just a few days ago where they finished, and Edwards came in first, followed by Obama, and then Clinton, and then Kucinich. I just thought you'd be interested.
Right, and Edwards took, like, what, 35-36% of the vote, and Obama and Clinton were something like 16-11%, as I recall, and Kucinich was around 9%.
37.65 for Edwards, 21.37 for Obama, and 20.43 for Clinton.
Yeah, okay, so my memory was semi-functional.
yeah,
and people could see that, by the way, over at txdemocrats.org, as I recall, is the website.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting. Every straw poll that we've done on this program, and we've been doing it for a couple of months now, has either had Edwards or Kucinich winning. And yeah. It would be interesting to hear that being done on other programs, particularly on program. I mean, like I think Stephanie Miller supports Barack Obama, for example. I've said, you know, I have a personal preference right now for Edwards, although I'm not endorsing anyone, whoever the nominee is. You know, I will, in my opinion, be a better president than any Republican, period, regardless of who it is. But it would be interesting to have other shows do the same kind of straw poll that we're doing and see if there's some sort of a, you know, if the listeners are reflecting the opinion of the host, which I frankly doubt, or if there really is a groundswell out there among people who are actually paying attention to politics for John Edwards and frankly for Dennis Kucinich as well, whereas the national polls that are being reported on by CBS, ABC, NBC, MSNBC, etc., are really just all they're really asking is name recognition. And of course, the people that the press obsess on are the people who get the greatest name recognition.
And is that how you explain the difference? Is just the name recognition? Why?
I think it is. I think that's why in those states that are close to primaries, where the voters are actually paying attention to what the candidates are saying, you find that Edwards is way ahead and Kucinich is showing respectively. And whereas in those states where there is not a primary imminent and they do the polls, there you have, you know, very high levels of support for Hillary Clinton and for Barack Obama. And I think that it's more name recognition than anything else. Although, you know, I may be wrong and time will tell. But Chris, thanks a lot for the call and for the heads up on it. I appreciate it. Jerry in Alberta, Canada. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hello, Tom?
Yeah, you're on
there.
Yeah,
Jerry here up in Edmonton. Up here, we have people working construction for $25 to $35 an hour.
That's well, we used to have that here, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, but when I watched Lou Dobbs and that, and they say that no one wants your construction jobs because they're only $10, $12 an hour.
Yeah.
But if you were paying people $25, $30 an hour building the houses and building that, things would be better.
That's right. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Jerry, and point well taken. And that is, and it's a very simple one. There is no such thing as a job nobody will do. I don't know. Maybe, you know, guinea pig to walk into a nuclear reactor, maybe nobody would do that. I mean, you know, rationally speaking, there's no such thing. However, there is such a thing as a job that nobody will do at a lousy wage. And that's what it comes down to. So, you know, this whole canard that, these are jobs Americans don't like, that's nonsense. Greg in Berkeley, California, listening on K-Green, K-G-R-N, the reinvention of the Quake. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hello?
Greg, you are on the air.
Oh, yes. I was listening to your comments about immigration earlier.
Yes, sir.
And the thing that I've always wondered about, though, is, you know, you see the protests, and I'm speaking particularly with Mexicans who, you know, have protests in the streets, and, you know, you'll see the Mexican flags, which always concerns a lot of us, because I'm sitting here and I'm going, there was a very close election in Mexico, and my hats were off to all those folks who did what we should have done several years ago, just taken to the streets and have the person put in office who ran.
Morales even created a shadow government for a while. You know, it ultimately fizzled out because he didn't have the support of the big corporate media. But a lot of us think that election in Mexico was stolen. And if 10, 12 million more people who were potentially politically active and potentially more progressive were down in Mexico to vote, it would have gone for Morales rather than for Calderon for the conservative. Good point. By the way, I just got a note from Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News. She said a panel in the Senate has just voted to raise the debt limit to $10 trillion. It's incredible. Senate Finance Committee approved legislation Wednesday to raise the debt limit to nearly $10 trillion. Why don't they just say to Bush, we're gonna raise taxes and stop inflating our debt. We're not going to pass any more expenses on to our children. You want to have your war in Iraq? Fine. Raise taxes. Mike in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Mike.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to make a comment, basically, and in fact, the point that you just made about the $10 trillion debt limit and immigration, illegal immigration, and buying products overseas and busting up labor unions. Everyone is seeming to want to attack the symptom and fix the symptom instead of dealing with the actual overlying issue, which is the strength of the U.S. dollar. And until we as citizens have a strong U.S. dollar, we cannot make the choices or have any type of power to reverse any of these symptoms from going on. For example, today, we're basically forced to buy products from China.
Well, we're not forced to. The fact of the matter is that if the dollar became stronger, Chinese products would actually become less expensive.
We are forced to everything is manufactured in China.
Right, but that's a matter of trade policy, not monetary policy. I mean, this is my big argument with the Milton Friedman folks. You know, they think that you can solve all problems by monetary policy, by changing the value of currencies relative to each other, and you can't. There are a lot of problems that require things like tariffs and trade rules.
No, it completely is a monetary issue because you have to equate the U.S. citizen with the U.S. dollar. So the weaker the U.S. dollar becomes, the weaker the U.S. citizen becomes in their political power. Because
the dollar becomes, the less wealthy we all become.
We are only valued by corporations. Right. We are seen as dollars.
Yeah.
And when our dollar is weak, we are weak.
I don't disagree with your point, Mike, but I think you're mistaking symptom for cause. But, you know, it's an interesting conversation, and hopefully we can continue it as time goes on. But right now we've got to take a break. Thank you for calling in. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. 866-303-2270, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com. Check out our blog, drop into our chat room. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Yeah, wouldn't that be a fine thing, to be the good guys again, to be one nation, to be united? Oh, man. 9.5 minutes before the hour. And tip of the hat, thanks to the folks in the chat room, specifically El Cid, who says, Tom, I think you were mixing up Andres Manuel López Obrador, the PRD candidate for Mexico's president, who probably won, with Evo Morales of Bolivia. You're right. I've been saying the wrong name for an hour for the guy who was running for president of Mexico. And I thank you. We have the smartest listeners in the world. I'm telling you, the combined intelligence of the people listening to this program, we could save the world, and someday we will, right? Abe in New York City. Hey, Abe, welcome to the program.
Tom.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if the reason that they're increasing the debt limit, et cetera, is so that eventually they can say that this nation is bankrupt and cancel Social Security and Medicare, et cetera.
If they were going to try that, they would not raise the debt limit. The reason that they're raising the debt limit is because the Democrats don't want to take on the Republicans on this. There's this huge don't rock the boat mentality among the Democratic Party. And Abe, I'm sorry, there's a terrible echo there. But thank you for the call and the question. Among the Democratic Party, there's this huge don't rock the boat mentality, which extends into don't impeach, don't hold accountable. I mean, this decision that has been made by Nancy Pelosi not to proceed with contempt of Congress citations or proceedings or whatever it's called, you know, against Gonzalez and company, against Harriet Myers. It's wrong, frankly, in my opinion. I mean, strong opinion. It's wrong. And the reason why Congress is doing so badly in the polls, in my opinion, and frankly, not just in my opinion, look at the polls out there, is because they're viewed as not having a spine. If the Democrats would stand up and speak out strongly against the Republicans and against these policies, frankly, I think that they'd gain in the polls. I mean, Karl Rove actually offered the advice on the way out. He said, start with your base and build from there. It's what the Republicans have been doing for 30 years, and it works. Toby in Weehawken, New Jersey. Hey, Toby.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to refer to the earlier caller who asked why we can't just look at this as a reasonable difference of opinion between Republicans and Democrats. And I, in all due respect, disagreed with your response that in many ways it is just a difference in opinion. But it's not. George Bush and the neocons are having a concerted, directed, massive effort to get the oil. And that's
let's just pause for a minute and break this out.
Okay.
First of all, I don't put George Bush in the category of the neocons. He's not a philosophical neocon.
He's a puppy of the neocons.
Exactly. I don't think he even understands the neoconservative point.
Okay.
So what George wanted to do, and Cindy Sheehan testified before John Conyers Commission about this, in 1999, when he was still governor of Texas, before he had even begun to campaign for president of the United States, the Bush family, Barbara and Bush George Sr., had hired a guy, Mickey Herskowitz, to write young George's autobiography that could be used as a book, you know, to help his campaign. It's called A Charge to Keep. It's in print. It's in the bookstores right now. And Mickey Herskowitz, the guy who wrote this book, on the record, said the following. And here's Cindy Sheehan testifying about this.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
Now, that's Bush in his own words. And so, in my view, Bush wanted to go into Iraq because he wanted political capital, and he wanted to use that to undo the New Deal, what he had campaigned in 1977 for the House of Representatives in Texas on, privatizing Social Security, et cetera. But he thought that becoming a war president would make him a big, big deal. So that was Bush's motivation. Cheney is a neocon and also is allied with the oil companies. And he saw it as an opportunity for his former company that he owns all these stock options in, and all his buddies to become billionaire buddies, and for a lot of money to be made. And then you got the guys like Wolfowitz, who had this ideology, this neoconservative ideology, that if they could just remake a country from scratch and prove that their conservative philosophy works. So they went into Iraq and they did away with progressive income tax and put in a flat 15% tax. They banned labor unions. They did away with the idea of illegal immigration by saying any corporation can bring in anybody from outside the country to work for any wage. They did away with minimum wage laws. They did away with socialized medicine. They did away with public education. They privatized the universities. They stopped all the welfare programs, and they thought that this was going to produce such a paradise that they didn't even have a plan that went beyond the first 3 months. That's a philosophy. They actually thought it was going to work. So your turn.
Yeah. Yeah, and they still do. The massive base that they're building is just concrete proof, literally and figuratively, that they have no intention of ever getting out.
But see, what they're not talking about is how their economic philosophy, which they've been trying to impose on this country since the 1940s, their economic philosophy, which they did impose on Iraq, led directly to the destruction of Iraq and led directly to the insurgency. And I would submit to you that it is destroying the United States as well in bits and pieces. Yeah, okay, so we're of the same mind. Toby, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you, and a great way to wrap up the show. I'm hopping on a plane. I will be back on Tuesday. In the meantime, Peter E. Collins will be filling in for me tomorrow. On Friday, Laura Flanders will be here. On Monday, Sam Cedar will be taking this seat and filling in for the show. And on Tuesday, I'll be back. So looking forward to a great time, and hope you enjoy the guest hosts and keep up the show. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag. You're it. Get out there and get active.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.